I crossed my fingers and said, "Agreed." "Good." He put out his hand and we shook. He said, "You're on." I was going to say, "You won't regret it, sir," but I thought maybe he would, so I just said, "I'll do my best." Koenig took a folder from Roberts and began leafing through it. I regarded Jack Koenig a moment and decided I should not underestimate him. He didn't get to this corner office because Uncle Sam was his mother's brother. He got here for all the usual reasons of hard work, long hours, intelligence, training, belief in his mission, good leadership skills, and probably patriotism. But a lot of people in the FBI had the same skills and qualifications. What distinguished Jack Koenig from other talented men and women was his willingness to accept responsibility for catastrophes that he'd been hired to prevent. What happened this afternoon was bad enough, but somewhere out there was a bad guy, Asad Khalil, and others like him, who wanted to nuke Midtown Manhattan, or poison the water supply, or wipe out the population with microorganisms. Jack Koenig knew this. We all knew this. But Koenig was ready to carry this burden and take the final rap if and when it happened. Like today. Koenig looked at Ted, Kate, and me, then nodded to Roberts, who picked up his pencil. The John Corey job interview and attitude adjustment period was over, and part two of the JFK disaster was about to begin. Koenig said to Kate, "I find it hard to believe that Flight 175 was without radio contact for over 2 hours and none of you knew about it." Kate replied, "Our only contact with the airline was through the gate agent, who knew very little. We'll have to reevaluate that procedure." "That's a good idea." He added, "You should also be in direct contact with air traffic control and tower control and the Port Authority Police Command Center." "Yes, sir." "If that flight had been hijacked in the air, it could have been in Cuba or Libya before you knew about it." "Yes, sir." She added, "Ted had the foresight to have the name and phone number of the tower supervisor." Koenig glanced at Nash and said, "Yes, good thinking, but you should have called him sooner." Nash didn't reply. I had the impression that Nash would say nothing that Mr. Roberts could jot down on his legal pad. Koenig continued, "It would appear that our February defector was on a dry run to see what our procedures are. I think we all suspected that after he bolted, hence the extra precautions this time." Koenig added, "If the February defector had been blindfolded, he wouldn't have seen the Conquistador Club, its location, or how to unlock the door. So maybe we should start blindfolding all non-authorized personnel, including so-called defectors and informants." He added, "Also, you'll recall that the February defector was brought in on a Saturday and saw how few people were at the Conquistador Club on a weekend." Part two, it seemed, was a review of policies and procedures, also called closing the cage after the lion escapes. Mr. Koenig went on in this vein for some time, speaking mostly to Kate, who was filling in for our fearless leader, George Foster. "All right," said Mr. Koenig. "The first indication you had that everything was not going as planned was when Ted called the tower control supervisor, a Mr. Stavros." Kate nodded. "That's when John wanted to go out to the aircraft, but Ted, George, and I..." "I've already noted that," said Mr. Koenig. I sort of wanted to hear it again, but Koenig pushed on and asked Ted Nash a direct and interesting question. He looked at Nash and said, "Did you anticipate a problem with this assignment?" Nash replied, "No." I thought otherwise, despite old Ted's crap about only the truth is spoken here. CIA types are so into deceit, deception, double and triple crosses, paranoia and bullshit, that you never knew what they knew, when they knew it, and what they were making up. This doesn't make them bad guys, and in fact, you have to admire their world-class bullshit. I mean, a CIA guy would lie to a priest in a confessional. But admiration aside, it's not easy to work with them if you're not one of them. In any case, Jack Koenig had asked the question and thereby raised the issue, but he let it go and said to me, "By the way, while I admire your initiative, when you got in that Port Authority car and crossed the runways, you lied to your superiors and broke every rule in the book. I'll let this pass, but don't let it happen again." I was a little pissed off now, and I said, if we'd acted about 10 minutes sooner, maybe Khalil would be in custody right now, charged with murder. If you'd instructed Hundry and Gorman to call and report on their cell phones or the airphone, we'd have known there was a problem when we didn't hear from them. If we'd been in direct contact with air traffic control, we'd have been told the aircraft was out of radio contact for hours. If you hadn't welcomed this February bozo with open arms, what happened today wouldn't have happened. I stood and announced, unless you need me for something important, I'm going home. When I used to pull this stunt with my bosses, someone would say, don't let the door hit you in the ass on your way out. But Mr. Koenig said softly, we need you for something important. Please sit down. Okay, so I sat. If I was back at Homicide North, this is when one of the bosses opens his desk and passes around the seltzer bottle of vodka to cool everyone down. But I didn't expect any rule-bending here in a place where they hung warning posters in the corridors about drinking, smoking, sexual harassment, and thought crimes. Anyway, we all sat there a moment, engaged, I guess, in Zen meditation, calming our nerves without nasty alcohol. Mr. Koenig went on with his agenda and asked me, you called George Foster on Kate's mobile phone and instructed him to put out a citywide. That's right. He went through the sequence and content of my cell phone calls to George Foster, then said, so you went back to the dome and saw that Phil's and Peter's thumbs had been severed. You understood what that meant. What else could it mean? Right. I congratulate you on an incredible piece of deductive reasoning. I mean, to go back and look for their thumbs. He looked at me and asked, how did you come to that thought, Mr. Corey? I really don't know. Sometimes things pop into my head. Really? Do you usually act on things that pop into your head? Well, if they're weird enough. You know, like severed thumbs. You have to go with that. I see. And you called the Conquistador Club and Nancy Tate didn't answer. I said, I think we've been through this. Koenig ignored this and said she was, in fact, dead by that time. Yes. That's why she didn't answer. And Nick Motti was also dead by that time. He was probably in the process of dying at that time. It takes a while with chest wounds. Out of nowhere, Koenig asked me, where did you get wounded? On West 102nd Street. I mean, where? I knew what he meant, but I don't like to discuss anatomy in mixed company. I replied, there wasn't much brain damage. He looked doubtful, but dropped that subject and looked at Ted. Do you have anything to add? No, I don't. Do you think that John and Kate missed any opportunities? Ted Nash considered this loaded question and replied, I think we all underestimated Asad Khalil. Koenig nodded. I think we did, but we won't do that again. Nash added, we all have to stop thinking of these people as idiots. That will get us into a lot of trouble. Koenig didn't reply. Nash continued, if I may say so, there is an attitudinal problem in the FBI and the NYPD intelligence unit regarding Islamic extremists. Part of this problem stems from racial attitudes. The Arabs and other ethnic groups in the Islamic world are not stupid or cowardly. Their armies or air forces may not impress us, but Mideastern terrorist organizations have scored some major hits around the world, in Israel and America. I've worked with Mossad, and they have a healthier respect for Islamic terrorists than we do. These extremists may not all be top-notch, but even bunglers can score once in a while. And sometimes you get an Asad Khalil. Needless to say, King Jack did not enjoy the lecture, but he appreciated its message. And that made Jack Koenig brighter than the average boss. I, too, was hearing what Nash was saying, and so did Kate. The CIA, despite my bad attitude toward its representative, had many strengths. One of its strengths was supposed to be in the area of enemy capability assessment, but they tended to overestimate the enemy, which was good for the CIA budget. I mean, the first inkling they had of the collapse of the Soviet Union was from the newspapers. On the other hand, there was some truth in what Ted Nash was saying. It's never a good idea to think of people who look, talk, and act differently from you as clowns, especially when they want to kill you. Jack Koenig said to Nash, I think everyone's attitudes are changing, but I agree with you that we still have some problems in that area. After today, we'll see some improvement in how we perceive our opponents. Now that Mr. Nash had made his philosophical point, he returned to the specific subject and said, It's my belief, as Kate told you earlier, that Khalil has left the country. Khalil is headed now to a Mideastern country on a Mideastern carrier. He will eventually wind up in Libya again, where he'll be debriefed and honored. We may never see him again, or we may see his handiwork a year from now. In the meantime, this is a matter best handled through international diplomacy and by international intelligence agencies. Koenig looked at Nash a while. I had the distinct impression they were not fond of each other. Koenig said, But you don't mind, Ted, if we continue to pursue leads here? Of course not. My, my, the fangs were bared for a brief moment. I thought we were a team. Mr. Koenig suggested to Mr. Nash, Since you have first-hand knowledge of this case, why don't you request a reassignment back to your agency? You would be invaluable to them on this case. Perhaps an overseas assignment. Nash got the drift and replied, If you feel you can spare me here, I'd like to go to Langley tonight or tomorrow and discuss that idea with them. I think it's a good idea. So do I, said Jack Koenig. It looked to me as though Ted Nash was about to disappear from my life, which made me very happy. On the other hand, I might miss old Ted. Then again, maybe I wouldn't. People like Nash who disappear have a habit of reappearing when you least expect or want them to. The polite but pissy exchange between Ted Nash and Jack Koenig seemed to be finished. I mentally lit a cigar, drank some scotch, and told a dirty joke to myself while Kate and Jack chatted. How do these people function without alcohol? How can they talk without swearing? But Koenig did let a few profanities slip out now and then. There was hope for him. In fact, Jack Koenig might have made a good cop, which is about the highest praise I can offer. There was a knock on the door and it opened. A young man stood in the doorway and said, Mr. Koenig, there's a call for you that you may want to take out here. Koenig stood, excused himself, and walked to the door. I noticed that the outer area, which had been empty and dark when we arrived, was now all lit up, and I saw men and women at their desks or walking around. A police station is never dark, quiet, or empty, but the feds try to keep normal work hours, trusting in a few duty officers and beepers to turn out the troops when the poopy hits the paddles. Anyway, Jack disappeared, and I turned to Hal Roberts and suggested, Why don't you find us some coffee? Mr. Roberts did not like being sent for coffee, but Kate and Ted seconded my suggestion, and Roberts got up and left. I regarded Kate a moment. Despite the day's events, she looked as fresh and alert as if it were 9 a.m. instead of 9 p.m. I myself felt my ass dragging. I'm about 10 years older than Ms. Mayfield, and I haven't fully recovered from my near-death experience, so that might explain the difference in our energy levels. But it didn't explain why her clothes and hair were so neat, and why she smelled good. I felt, and probably looked, crumpled, and I needed a shower about now. Nash looked dapper and awake, but that's the way mannequins always looked. Also, he hadn't done anything physical today. Certainly he hadn't had a wild ride around the airport or climbed through an aircraft full of corpses. But back to Kate. She had her legs crossed, and I noticed for the first time what good legs they were. Actually, I may have noticed this about a month ago in the first nanosecond after meeting her, but I'm trying to modify my NYPD piggishness. I have not hit on one single or married female in the ATTF. I was actually getting a reputation as a man who was either devoted to duty or was devoted to some off-scene girlfriend, or was gay, or who had a low libido, or who perhaps had been hit below the belt by one of those bullets. In any case, a whole new world was opening up to me now. Women in the office talked to me about their boyfriends and husbands, asked me if I liked their new hairstyles, and generally treated me in a gender-neutral manner. The girls haven't yet asked me to go shopping with them or shared recipes with me, but maybe I'll be invited to a baby shower. The old John Corey is dead, buried under a ton of politically correct memos from Washington. John Corey, NYPD homicide, is history. Special contract agent John Corey, ATTF, has emerged. I feel clean, baptized in Potomac holy water, reborn and accepted into the ranks of the pure angelic hosts with whom I work. But back to Kate. Her skirt had ridden above her knees, and I was treated to this incredible left thigh. I realized she was looking at me, and I tore my eyes away from her legs and looked at her face. Her lips were fuller than I'd thought, pouty and expressive. Those ice blue eyes were looking deep into my soul. Kate said to me, "You do look like you need coffee." I cleared my throat and my mind and replied, "I actually need a drink." She said, "I'll buy you one later." I glanced at my watch and said, "I'm usually in bed by 10. She smiled but didn't reply. My heart was pounding. Meanwhile, Nash was being Nash, totally unconnected, as inscrutable as a Tibetan monk on Quaaludes. It occurred to me again that maybe the guy was not aloof. Maybe he was stupid. Maybe he had the IQ of a toaster oven. But he was bright enough not to let on. Mr. Roberts returned with a tray on which was a carafe and 4 coffee mugs. He set this down on the table without comment and didn't even offer to pour. I took the carafe and poured 3 mugs of hot coffee. Kate, Ted, and I each took a mug and sipped. We all stood and went to the windows, each of us lost in our own thoughts as we stared out into the city. I looked east, out toward Long Island. There was a nice cottage out there, about 90 miles and a world away from here, and in the cottage was Beth Penrose, sitting in front of a fire, sipping tea or maybe brandy. It wasn't a good idea to dwell on those kinds of things, but I remembered what my ex-wife once said to me. "A man like you, John, does only what he wants to do. You want to be a cop, so don't complain about the job. When you're ready, you'll give it up. But you're not ready." Indeed not. But at times like this, the idiot students at John Jay were looking good. I glanced at Kate and saw she was looking at me. I smiled. She smiled. We both turned back to our views. For most of my professional life, I had done work that was considered important. Everyone in this room knew that special feeling. But it took its toll on the mind and on the spirit, and sometimes, as in my case, on the body. Yet something kept pushing me on. My ex had concluded, "You'll never die of boredom, John, but you will die on this job. Half of you is dead already." Not true. Simply not true. What was true was that I was addicted to the adrenaline rush. Also, I actually felt good about protecting society. That's not something you'd say in the squad room, but it was a fact and a factor. Maybe after this case was over, I'd think about all this. Maybe it was time to put down the gun and the shield and get out of harm's way. Time to make my exit. Chapter 20. Asad Khalil continued on through a residential neighborhood. The Mercury Marquis was big, bigger than anything he'd ever driven, but it handled well enough. Khalil did not go to the toll highway called the New Jersey Turnpike. He had no intention of going through any toll booths. As he had requested in Tripoli, the rented automobile had a global positioning system, which he'd used in Europe. This one was called a satellite navigator, and it was slightly different from the ones he was used to, but it had the entire U.S. roadway system in its database, and as he drove slowly through the streets, he accessed the directions to Highway 1. Within a few minutes, he was on the highway heading south. This was a busy road, he noticed, with many commercial establishments on either side. He noticed that some automobiles coming toward him had their headlights on, so he put on his headlights. After a mile or so, he dropped Jabbar's keys out the window, then removed Jabbar's cash from his wallet, counting $87. He went through Jabbar's wallet as he drove, ripping up what could be ripped and dropping small pieces out the window. The credit cards and plasticized driving license presented a problem, but Khalil managed to bend and break them all and let them fall out his window. The wallet now contained nothing except a color photograph of the Jabbar family. Gamal Jabbar, a wife, two sons, a daughter, and an elderly woman. Khalil regarded the photograph as he drove. He had been able to retrieve a few photographs from the ruins of his home in Al-Aziziyah, including a few photographs of his father in uniform. These images were precious to him, and there would be no further photographs of the family of Khalil. Asad Khalil tore the Jabbar family photograph in four pieces and let it fly out the window, followed by the wallet, then the plastic bottle, and finally the shell casing. All the evidence was now strewn over many miles of the highway and would attract no attention. Khalil reached over, opened the glove box, and pulled out a stack of papers. Rental forms, maps, some advertisements, and other papers that had little purpose. The Americans, he saw, like the Europeans, loved useless papers. He glanced through the rental agreement and confirmed that the name on the agreement matched his passport. He turned his attention back to the road. There were many bad drivers on the road here. He saw very young people driving and very old people driving, and many women were driving. No one seemed to drive well. They drove better in Europe, except for Italy. The drivers in Tripoli were like Italian drivers. Khalil realized he could drive badly here and not be noticed. He looked at his gas gauge and saw that it read full. A police car came into view in his side mirror and stayed behind him for a while. Khalil maintained his speed and did not change lanes. He resisted glancing too often in the side view or rear view mirror. That would make the policeman suspicious. Khalil put on his bifocal glasses. After a full 5 minutes, the police car pulled into the outside lane and came alongside of him. Khalil noticed that the policeman didn't even give him a glance. Soon, the police car was ahead of him. Khalil settled back and paid attention to the traffic. They had told him in Tripoli that there would be much traffic on a Saturday night. Many people visited or went to restaurants or movie theaters or shopping malls. This was not too different from Europe, except for the shopping malls. In Tripoli, they also told him that in the more rural areas, the police were looking at cars that might be driven by dealers of drugs. This could be a problem, they warned him, as the police sometimes looked for drivers who were of the black or Spanish race, and they might stop an Arabic man by mistake or even on purpose. But at night, it was difficult to see who was driving, and now the sun was setting. Asad Khalil thought for a minute about Gamal Jabbar. He took no pleasure in killing a fellow Muslim, but each believer in Islam was expected to fight or to sacrifice or to be martyred in the jihad against the West. Too many Muslims, such as Gamal Jabbar, did nothing except send money back to their homelands. Jabbar did not actually deserve death, Khalil thought, but death became the only possibility. Asad Khalil was on a holy mission, and others had to sacrifice so that he could do what they couldn't do. Kill the infidel. His only other thought about Gamal Jabbar was a passing concern that the man could have survived the single bullet. But Khalil had seen that twitching before and heard that gurgling. The man was dead. May Allah take him into paradise this very night. The sun was setting, but it was not practical to stop to perform the salat. He had been given dispensation from the mullah for the time he was engaged in the jihad, but he would not fail to say his prayers. In his mind, he prostrated himself on his prayer rug and faced Mecca. He recited, God is most great. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah. I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. Hasten to Salat. Hasten to success. God is most great. There is no God but Allah. He recited random passages from the Quran. Kill the aggressors wherever you find them. Drive them out of the places from which they drove you. Fight them until Allah's religion is supreme. Fight for the cause of Allah with the devotion due to Him. Permission to take up arms is hereby given to those who are attacked. Allah has the power to grant them victory. Believers, fear Allah as you rightly should, and when death comes, die true Muslims. If you have suffered a defeat, so did the enemy. We alternate these victories among mankind so that Allah may know true believers and choose martyrs from among you, and that he may test the faithful and annihilate the infidels. Allah is the supreme plotter. Satisfied that he had fulfilled his obligations, he felt at peace as he drove through the strange land, surrounded by enemies and infidels. Then he recalled the ancient Arab war song, and he sang the song called the Death Feud. Terrible, he rode alone with his Yemen sword for aid. Ornament, it carried none but the notches on the blade. Chapter 21. Jack Koenig returned with some papers in his hand that looked like faxes. We all sat, and he said to us, I spoke to the crime lab supervisor at JFK. They have a preliminary report. He tapped the papers on the coffee table, of the scenes of the aircraft and the Conquistador Club. He added, I also spoke to George, who has offered to transfer out of the ATTF and out of New York. He let that hang there for a few seconds, then asked Kate, Yes? No? No. Koenig addressed Kate and me and said, Can you two speculate or guess as to what happened on the aircraft before it landed? Kate said, John is the detective. Koenig said to me, You're on, detective. I should point out here that the FBI uses the term investigator to describe what amounts to a detective, so I didn't know if I was being honored or patronized. In any case, this is partly what I was hired for, of course, and I'm good at this stuff. But Koenig made no secret of the fact that he just got some answers to the questions he was asking. So rather than making an idiot of myself, I asked Koenig, I assume they found those two oxygen bottles in the dome coat closet. Yes, they did. But as you discovered, both had their valves open, so we don't know what was in them. But we can assume that one was oxygen and the other wasn't. He said to me, Proceed. Okay, about 2 hours outside of New York, air traffic control lost contact with Transcontinental 175. So it was then that the guy with the medical oxygen bottles, probably sitting in business class in the dome. Correct, said Mr. Koenig. His name was Youssef Haddad, seat 2A. Okay, this guy. What's his name? Youssef Haddad. Means Joe Smith. He's on the manifest with a Jordanian passport and medical oxygen required for emphysema. The passport's probably a fake, so was the emphysema, and so was one of the oxygen bottles. Right, okay. Joe Smith, business class Jordanian in seat 2A. This guy is breathing the real oxygen. Then he reaches down and opens the valve of the second bottle. A gas escapes and gets into the closed air conditioning system of the aircraft. Correct. What kind of gas? Well, it was something nasty like cyanide. Very good. It was most probably a hemotoxin, maybe a military form of cyanide. The victims basically suffocated. The lab will analyze blood and tissue tonight and see if they can identify it. Not that it matters, but that's the way they work. Anyway, within 10 minutes, all the air on board is recirculated, so everyone got a dose of this gas except Youssef Haddad, who was still breathing pure oxygen. He looked at me and said, Tell me how Khalil escaped death. Well, I'm not sure of the sequence of events, but I'm thinking that Khalil was in the lab when the gas escaped. The lavatory might be less toxic than the cabin air. In fact, Koenig said, it is not, but the exhaust flow of air from the lab is vented directly out of the aircraft, which is why everyone in the cabins can't smell it when someone sits on the potty. Interesting. I mean, I once took an Aeromexico flight to Cancun where they served a lunch consisting of 22 different bean dishes, and I was surprised the plane didn't explode in midair. I said, so the lav is toxic and Khalil is breathing as little as possible and maybe has a wet paper towel over his face. Haddad has to make his move very quickly to get to Khalil, either with his own oxygen or one of those small oxygen bottles that are carried on board for medical emergencies. Koenig nodded, but said nothing. Kate said, What I don't understand is how Haddad and Asad Khalil knew that the aircraft was pre-programmed to land itself. Koenig replied, I'm not sure either. We're checking that out. He looked at me and said, continue. Okay, so within 10 minutes, there are only two people alive on board the aircraft, Assad Khalil and his accomplice, Yousef Haddad. Haddad finds the handcuff keys on Peter Gorman and uncuffs Khalil in the lav. The poison gas is eventually vented, and after they're certain that the air is safe to breathe, maybe 15 minutes, they get off the oxygen. Kate and I didn't see the aircraft's emergency oxygen bottle lying around, so I assume that Haddad or Khalil put it back where it's usually stored. Then they put Haddad's medical oxygen in the dome coat closet where we found it. Yes, Koenig replied. They wanted everything to look fairly normal when the aircraft was first boarded at JFK. Assuming Peter or Phil had died near the lav, they also put that person's body back in his seat. Continue, Mr. Corey. I continued. Okay, Khalil must not have killed Haddad immediately because Haddad's body was warmer than everyone else's. So these two guys tidy up things, maybe go through Phil and Peter's belongings, take their guns, then probably go down to first and coach and make sure everyone is dead. At some point, Khalil doesn't need any more company, and he breaks Haddad's neck, as Kate discovered. He puts Haddad next to Phil, cuffs him, and puts the sleeping mask on him. I added, somewhere along the line, Khalil took the thumbs. Correct, Koenig said. The lab found a knife in the dome galley with traces of wiped blood, and they found the napkin used to wipe the knife hidden in the galley trash. Had anyone who first boarded seen a bloody knife, that would have gotten some attention. Had you or Kate seen it, you'd have come to the conclusion you came to even sooner. Right. What you first see when you arrive at a crime scene is often what the perpetrator wants you to see. Further investigation, however, turns up the ropes and pulleys behind the scenery. Koenig looked at us and said, At some point while the aircraft was being towed, Sergeant Andy McGill of the Port Authority Emergency Service Unit made a final transmission to his people. We all nodded. I said McGill and Khalil may have stumbled on each other by accident. Koenig regarded his faxes and said, Preliminary evidence, blood, brain, and bone tissue, suggests that McGill was killed between the galley and the lav, facing the lav. Some tissue was sprayed into the galley, some of it landing on the dead flight attendant, although someone made an attempt to wipe it up, which is why you may not have noticed it, Koenig said pointedly. He added, So maybe McGill opened the lav door and discovered Assad Khalil. Also, forensic found a lap blanket with a hole and burn marks indicating that the blanket was used to muffle the sound of the gunshot. I nodded. It's always amazing what the forensic people can tell you very quickly and how quickly a detective can make deductions and recreate the crime. It didn't matter that this was a terrorist incident. A crime scene is a crime scene. Murder was murder. The only thing missing was the murderer. Koenig continued, Regarding Khalil's escape from the aircraft, we can assume he knew what the procedure would be at JFK. With the pilots dead, any emergency service personnel entering the aircraft would shut down the engines. At that point, a tow truck would be summoned and the aircraft would be taken to the security area. You know the rest. Indeed, we did. Koenig added, Also, we found what we assume was Yousef Haddad's hang-up garment bag. Under a suit was a blue transcontinental baggage handler's jumpsuit that was meant for Mr. Haddad. There was in that garment bag undoubtedly a second jumpsuit for Assad Khalil, and he had it on at some point, knowing that baggage handlers would come aboard to collect carry-on luggage. He looked at Kate, then at me, and asked, Did either of you notice anyone who looked suspicious? You knew something was wrong, yet Khalil got away. I replied, I think he was gone when we got there. He may have been. Then again, maybe he wasn't. Maybe you bumped into him. Kate said, I think we would have recognized him. Do you? Not if he was wearing a baggage handler's jumpsuit, combed his hair differently, was wearing glasses and a phony mustache. But maybe he saw you. Maybe at some point he realized there were federal agents or detectives on board. Think about that. Try to recall what happened and who you saw on the aircraft and in that security area. Okay, Jack, I'll think about it. Thanks for mentioning it. Koenig continued. In any case, Khalil got into an empty baggage truck and drove off. At this point, most men who just pulled off one of the most ballsy moves, excuse my language, one of the most audacious moves in terrorist history would get to the international terminal, get out of that jumpsuit under which was street clothing, and get on an outbound flight for Sandland. Forgive my characterization of the Middle East. But no, Asad Khalil is not going home, not yet. He has to make a stop at the Conquistador Club first. The rest, as they say, is history. No one spoke for a full minute. Then Koenig observed, "This is a very resourceful, clever, and bold individual. He exploits situations quickly and without hesitation or fear of getting caught. He relies on other people being either preoccupied or unaware that there is a psychopathic killer in their midst. Speed, savagery, and shock. Decisiveness, daring, and deception. Understand?" We all understood. If I had the inclination, I could tell Jack Koenig about 10 or 15 such killers I'd come across over the years. The really good psychotic killers were just as Koenig described. You couldn't believe the stuff they got away with. You couldn't believe how stupid and trusting their victims were. Mr. Koenig continued his thoughts and said, "There are other scenarios regarding how Khalil's plan might work out. The worst scenario for him was that the aircraft simply crashed and killed everyone on board, including Khalil. He would have accepted that, I think, and called it a win." We all sort of nodded. The boss was on. "Another possibility," Koenig continued, "is that he'd get caught on the ground and be identified as the killer. That would also be okay with him. He'd still be a hero in Tripoli." Again, we nodded, starting to appreciate not only Koenig, but also Khalil. Koenig said, "Yet another possibility is that he escapes from the aircraft, but is not able to carry out his mission at the Conquistador Club. In any case, Asad Khalil couldn't lose once Youssef Haddad was on board with his medical oxygen and poison gas. In fact, even if Youssef Haddad had been stopped before he boarded the aircraft in Paris, Asad Khalil would still have wound up in the Conquistador Club, though he'd be guarded and cuffed. But who knows how that would have played out later." Everyone thought about Asad Khalil back at the Conquistador Club as planned. At what point would this guy go psychotic? Mr. Koenig concluded with, "Other scenarios aside, Asad Khalil hit a grand slam home run. He cleared the bases and he's on the way to home plate. Whether that means a safe house in America or back to Libya, we don't know yet." He added, "But we'll play it as though he's close by and waiting to hit again." Since we were out of facts and into speculation, I speculated, "I think this guy is a loner and he won't be turning up at the usual watched houses or hanging around the local mosque with the usual suspects." Kate concurred and added, "He may have one contact here, maybe the February guy or someone else. Assuming he needs no help after the initial contact, we can expect to find another accomplice's body somewhere soon. I'm also assuming he had a man at JFK to help him get out of there, and that could be the guy who turns up dead. We should give the NYPD a heads up on that." Koenig nodded. He looked at Nash. "Why do you think he's gone?" Nash didn't reply for a second or two, giving the impression that he was tired of casting pearls before swine. Finally, he leaned forward and looked at each of us. He said, "We've described Khalil's entrance into this country as grand and dramatic, and Mr. Koenig is correct that no matter how any of those scenarios played out, Khalil was a winner. He was ready to sacrifice his life in the service of Allah and join his brethren in paradise. This was one hell of a risky way to sneak into a hostile country." "We know that," Koenig said. "Hear me out, Mr. Koenig. This is important and actually some good news. All right, back this thing up and postulate that Asad Khalil was coming to America to blow up this building or the one across the street or all of New York City or Washington. Postulate a nuclear device hidden somewhere or, more likely, a ton of toxic gas or 1,000 liters of anthrax. If Asad Khalil was the man who was supposed to deliver any of these weapons of mass death and destruction, then he would have come into Canada or Mexico on a false passport and slipped easily over the border to accomplish this important mission, he would not have arrived as he did with a high risk of getting caught or killed. What we saw today was a classical seagull mission. He looked around at us and explained, "You know, a person flies in, makes a lot of noise, craps all over everything, then flies out. Mr. Khalil was on a seagull mission. Mission accomplished. He's gone." So we all thought about seagull missions. Old Ted had spoken and revealed that he had the IQ of at least a VCR. This was irrefutable logic. The silence in the room told me that everyone had finally seen the incandescent brilliance of Nash's mind at work. Koenig nodded and said, "Makes sense to me." Kate nodded too and said, "I think Ted is right. What Khalil was sent here to do, he did. There's no second act to come. His mission ended at JFK, and he was perfectly positioned to take any one of dozens of late afternoon flights out." Koenig looked at me. "Mr. Corey?" I, too, nodded. "Makes sense to me. Ted makes a strong case for his theory." Koenig thought a moment and said, "Still, we have to proceed as if Khalil may still be in this country. We've notified every law enforcement agency in the U.S. and in Canada. We've also called up every ATTF agent we could find tonight, and we're staking out every place where a Mideast terrorist might turn up. We've also alerted the Port Authority Police, NYPD, New Jersey, Connecticut, suburban counties, and so forth. The more time that goes by, the bigger the search area gets. If he's hiding out, perhaps waiting to get out of the country, we may still nab him close by. Containment is the first priority." Nash informed us, "I called Langley from JFK, and they put out a high-priority watch and detain at all international airports where we have assets." He looked at me. "That means people who work for us, with us, or are us." "Thank you. I read spy novels." So that was it. Asad Khalil was either already out of the country or was in hiding, waiting to get out. This really did make the most sense considering what happened today and how it happened. There were, however, a few things that bothered me, a detail or two that didn't fit. The first and most obvious was the question of why Asad Khalil had turned himself in to the CIA liaison guy at the Paris embassy. A much simpler plan would have been for Khalil to just get on board Transcontinental Flight 175 with a false passport, the way Joe Smith, his accomplice, did. The same poison gas plan would have worked better if Khalil was not in cuffs and not guarded by two armed federal agents. The thing Nash was missing was the human element, which is what you'd expect Nash to miss. You had to understand Asad Khalil to understand what he was up to. He didn't want to be another anonymous terrorist. He wanted to walk into the Paris embassy, get himself cuffed and guarded, then escape like Houdini. This was still an in-your-fucking-face act on his part, not a seagull mission. He wanted to read what we knew about him. He wanted to cut off thumbs and go to the Conquistador Club and murder anyone who was there. It was definitely a high-risk operation, but what was unique about it was the personal nature of it. It was, in fact, an insult, a humiliation, like an ancient warrior riding alone into an enemy camp and raping the chief's wife. The only question in my mind was whether or not Asad Khalil was finished fucking the Americans. I didn't think he was. The guy was on a roll. But I agreed with Nash now that Khalil didn't have a nuke that needed to be detonated or poison gas or germs that needed to be spread. I was going with a gut feeling that Asad Khalil, the lion, was in America to push more shit in our faces up close and personal. I would not have been completely surprised if he showed up on the 28th floor and cut some throats and broke some necks. So it was time to share this feeling with my teammates, time to reveal my ace to King Jack, if you'll pardon the metaphor or whatever the hell that is. But my colleagues were chatting about something else, and while I waited for an opportunity to talk, I had second thoughts about these things that bothered me and this feeling that Asad Khalil was trying keys to the elevator about now. So I let it go for the time being and tuned back in. Kate was saying to Jack Koenig, "Obviously, Khalil read everything in Phil's and Peter's briefcases." Koenig replied, too matter-of-factly, I thought, "They didn't have much with them." Kate pointed out, "Asad Khalil now has our dossier on Asad Khalil." "There wasn't that much in it," Koenig said. "Not much he didn't already know about himself." Kate pressed the point. "But now he knows how little we know." "All right, I get it. Anything else?" "Yes. In the dossier was a memo from Zach Weber. It was just an operations memo, but it was addressed to George Foster, Kate Mayfield, Ted Nash, Nick Monty, and John Corey." "Holy shit. I never thought of that." Jack Koenig, in his understated way, said, "Well then, be careful." "Thanks, Jack." He added, "But I doubt if Khalil..." He thought about it, then advised us, "We know what this man is capable of, but we don't know what he plans to do. I don't think you're in his plans." Kate had another thought about that and said, "We agreed that we shouldn't underestimate this man." "Neither should we overestimate him," Koenig replied curtly. "There's a switch. The FBI, like the CIA, usually overestimates everything. It's good for their budget and their image." But I kept that thought to myself. Kate continued, "We have rarely seen a terrorist act like this. Most acts of terrorism are either random or remote, such as bombings. This man is suspected of personally murdering people in Europe, and I don't have to tell you what he just did here. There's something about this guy that bothers me, aside from the obvious." "And what do you think that is?" Mr. Koenig asked. "I don't know," she replied. "But unlike most terrorists, Khalil has shown a lot of intelligence and courage." Koenig commented, "Like a lion." "Yes, like a lion. But we shouldn't get too metaphorical. He's a man, and he's a killer, and that makes him more dangerous than any lion." Kate Mayfield was coming close to the heart of the matter, closer to an understanding of Asad Khalil. But she didn't say anything else, and no one ran with her thoughts. We discussed the personality types of killers for a minute or two, and the FBI is really good at this kind of psychological profiling. A lot of it sounded psychobabbly to me, but some of it was on the mark. I offered my assessment and said, "I get the feeling that Khalil has a hard-on for Americans." "Excuse me?" said Mr. Koenig. "A what?" I regretted my lapse into station house jargon, and I clarified my noun. "He has more than a philosophical or political agenda. He has a burning hatred for Americans as people." I added, "I think in light of today's events, we can assume that some or all of the suspicions and allegations contained in Khalil's dossier are in fact true. If so, then he murdered an American Air Force officer with an axe. He shot down 3 innocent American school kids in Brussels. If we can figure out why, then maybe we can figure out what's bothering this guy, and maybe what's next and who's next." Nash piped in and said, "He's also targeted the Brits. We think he exploded a bomb in the British embassy in Rome. So your theory about him having an obsession with killing only Americans doesn't hold up." I replied, "If he did bomb that British embassy, then there's a connection. He doesn't like Brits or Americans. Connections are always clues." Nash sort of laughed at me. "I really don't like it when people do that." Koenig looked at Nash. "You disagree with Mr. Corey?" Nash replied, "Mr. Corey is mixing police work and intelligence work. The model for one doesn't necessarily apply as the model for the other." "Not necessarily," Koenig said, "but sometimes." Nash shrugged, then said, "Even if Asad Khalil was targeting only Americans, that doesn't make him unique. In fact, quite the opposite. Most terrorists target America and Americans. That's our reward for being number one, for being pro-Israel, for the Gulf War, and for our worldwide anti-terrorist operations." Koenig nodded, but said, "Still, there's the matter of Khalil's unique style. his up-close, personal, insulting, and humiliating modus operandi. Nash again shrugged. So what? That's his style, and even if it were a clue to his future plans, we couldn't head him off. We're not going to catch him on a mission. He has a million targets, and he chooses the target, the time, and the place. Seagull missions. No one replied. Ted Nash concluded, In any event, you know that I'm convinced that what happened today was the mission and that Khalil is gone. He may strike next in Europe, where he's apparently struck before and where he knows the terrain and where security is not always consistent. And yes, he may come back here someday. But for now, the lion is full, to continue the metaphor. He's on his way back to his lair in Libya, and he won't come out again until he's hungry. I thought about offering my Dracula metaphor. The ship arriving like magic with a dead crew and passengers and Drac slipping into a totally clueless country full of porky people with good veins and all that. But Mr. Koenig seemed to think I was a logical guy with good instincts and no metaphorical thoughts. So I bagged the Dracula thing and said, Not to be contrary, but based on what we saw today, I still think that Khalil is within 50 miles of where we're sitting. I have a $10 bet with Ted that we hear from him soon. Mr. Koenig managed the smile. Do you? You'd better let me hold the money. Ted's leaving for overseas. Koenig wasn't kidding and held out his hand. Nash and I each put $10 in his hand, which he pocketed. Kate sort of rolled her eyes. Boys will be boys. Jack Koenig looked at me and said, So Khalil is out there somewhere, and he has your name, Mr. Corey. Do you think you're now on his menu? I guess we were back to lion metaphors, and I got the meaning, which I didn't like. Koenig informed me, Sometimes the hunters become the hunted. He looked at Nash. For instance, a Mideast terrorist murdered two men in the parking lot of CIA headquarters. Ted Nash looked as if he'd rather forget that. He replied, The victims were both CIA employees, but they were random targets. The killer didn't know them. The institution was the target. Jack Koenig didn't reply. He said to Kate, Ted, and me, If Asad Khalil is still in this country, you were not the reason he came here originally, but you may now be on his list of targets. Actually, I see this as an opportunity. I leaned forward. Excuse me? What? Opportunity. Well, I hate to use the word bait, but bad idea. Let's drop that. He didn't want to drop it and got back to the lion metaphor. You have this rogue lion who's eating villagers, and you have these hunters who almost caught the lion. The lion is angry at the hunters, and he makes the fatal mistake of going after the hunters, right? Nash seemed amused. Kate seemed to be considering it. Koenig said, We'll put out a news story about John and Kate and maybe even use your pictures, although we'd never do that normally. Khalil will think it's standard to use names and photos of agents in America, and he won't suspect a trap, right? I said, I don't think that's in my contract. Koenig continued, We won't and can't use Ted's name and photo because his agency would never allow that. George is married and has children, and we won't take that risk, but you, John, and you, Kate, are single and you live alone, correct? Kate nodded. I said, Why don't we shelve this idea for a while? Because if you're correct, Mr. Corey, and Khalil is still in this country and close to where we sit, he may be tempted to go for a target of opportunity before he moves on to his next target, which could be far bigger than what he's already done. That's why. I'm trying to head off another mass murder. Sometimes an individual has to put himself or herself in harm's way for the greater safety and security of the nation. Don't you agree? Kate said, I agree. It's worth a try. I'd gotten myself into a lose-lose situation. I said, great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Nash observed, And if John is wrong and Khalil is out of the country, John only loses $10. If Khalil is in the country, John wins $10, but, well, Let's not think about that. Ted Nash was really enjoying himself for the first time that I can remember. I mean, old, stoic Ted was grinning at the prospect of John Corey getting his throat slashed by some psychotic camel jockey. Even Mr. Roberts was trying to suppress a grin. Funny what turns people on. The meeting went on for a while longer. We were now into the public relations problems, which could be sticky with 300 people dead on board the aircraft, people murdered on the ground, and the perp at large. Jack Koenig concluded with, "The next few days are going to be very difficult. The news media are generally friendly toward us, as we saw in the World Trade Center case and the TWA case. But we have to control the news a little. Also, we have to go to Washington tomorrow and assure those people that we are on top of things. I want everyone to go home and get some sleep. Meet me at the U.S. Airways shuttle at LaGuardia for the first flight at 7 a.m. George will stay at the Conquistador Club and supervise the crime scene." He stood, and we all stood with him. He said, "Despite the outcome of today's assignment, you all did a fine job." He surprised me by saying, "Pray for the dead." We all shook hands, even Mr. Roberts. Kate, Ted, and I left. As we walked through the 28th floor, I felt a lot of eyes on us. Chapter 22. Asad Khalil knew he had to cross the Delaware River at a bridge with no toll, and he had been instructed to continue on Highway 1 to the city of Trenton, where there were two such bridges. He programmed the satellite navigator as he drove. It would have been easier if the man who had rented the car had programmed the satellite navigator or asked the car rental agency to do it, but that was a dangerous convenience. Khalil's last and only need for assistance and last point where he could be traced was Gamal Jabbar in the parking lot. Khalil exited Highway 1 onto Interstate 95. This was a good road, much like the German Autobahn, he thought, except the vehicles moved more slowly here. The interstate took him around the city of Trenton. He saw near an exit a brown sign saying Washington Crossing State Park. He recalled that his Russian training officer, Boris, a former KGB man who had lived in America, had said to him, "You will be crossing the Delaware River near where George Washington crossed 200 years ago by boat." He didn't want to pay a toll either. Khalil did not always understand Boris's humor, but Boris was the one man in Tripoli who could be counted on to give good advice about America and Americans. Khalil crossed the toll-free bridge into the state of Pennsylvania. He continued on I-95 heading south as the satellite navigator instructed. The sun was fully set now, and it was dark. Soon he found that I-95 went through the city of Philadelphia. There was much traffic, and he had to slow down. He could see tall, lighted buildings, and at one point he drove parallel to the Delaware River. Then he passed the airport. This was not the fastest or most direct route to his destination, but it was a heavily traveled route, without tolls, and therefore the safest route for him. Soon the city was behind him, and the vehicles began moving more quickly. He let his thoughts turn to other matters. His first thought was that this day of April 15th had begun well. And by now in Tripoli, the great leader knew that Asad Khalil had arrived in America and that hundreds had been slain to avenge this day and that more would die in the coming days. The great leader would be pleased, and soon all of Tripoli and all of Libya would know that a blow had been struck to redeem the nation's honor. Malik would be awake, even at this early morning hour in Tripoli, and he would also know by now, and he would bless Asad Khalil and pray for him. Khalil wondered if the Americans would retaliate against his country. It was difficult to guess what this American president would do. The great Satan, Reagan, had at least been predictable. This president was sometimes weak, sometimes strong. In any case, even retaliation would be good. It would awaken all of Libya and all of Islam. Khalil turned on the radio and heard people talking about their sexual problems. He set the frequency to a news station and listened for 10 minutes before the story of the aircraft came on. He listened carefully to the man speaking, then to other people speaking about what they called the tragedy. It was clear to Khalil that the authorities either did not know what happened or they knew and they were hiding it. In either case, even if the police were in a high state of alert, the general population was not. This made things much easier for him. Asad Khalil continued south on Route I-95. The dashboard clock told him it was 8:10 p.m. There was still traffic on the road, enough so that his car would not attract attention. He passed several exits that led to rest stops, brightly lit places in which he could see cars, people, and gasoline pumps. But his fuel gauge read over half full, and he wasn't hungry. He took the second liter bottle of water from the overnight bag, finished the water, then urinated in the bottle, screwed the cap back on, and put the bottle under the passenger seat. He was, he realized, tired, but not so tired as to fall asleep. He'd slept well on the aircraft. They had told him in Tripoli to try to drive through the night, that the more distance he put between himself and what he had left behind, the better his chances would be to escape detection. Soon he would be in yet another jurisdiction, Delaware, and the more jurisdictions he was from New York and New Jersey, they'd told him, the less likely it would be that the local police would be alerted. In any case, the police had no idea what they were looking for. Certainly they didn't know to look for a black Mercury Marquis heading south on any one of many roads. Only a random stop by a patrol car would be a problem, and even then, Khalil knew that his papers were in order. He'd been stopped twice in Europe, where they always demanded to see a passport, and at times a visa as well as all the papers for the rental car. Both times he had been sent on his way. Here, according to his people in Tripoli, they wanted to see only a driver's license and a registration for the car, and they wanted to know if you had been drinking alcohol. His religion forbade alcohol, but he was not supposed to say this. Say only, no. But again, he could not conceive of a situation with the police that would last too long before one of them was dead. Also, as they had told him, the police usually drove alone, which he found somewhat incredible. Boris, who had spent 5 years in America, had given him instructions for when he was out of the taxi and driving on his own. Boris had said, "Stay in your car. The policeman will come to you and lean into your window or order you out of the car. One bullet to his head and you are on your way. But he has radioed your license plate number to his headquarters before he stopped you, and he may have a video camera on his dashboard recording the event. So, you must abandon your automobile as soon as possible and find other transportation. You will have no contacts to help you, Asad. You are on your own until you reach the west coast of America." Khalil had recalled replying, "I have been on my own since the 15th of April, 1986. At 20 minutes after 9 p.m., Khalil crossed into the state of Delaware. Within 15 minutes, I-95 turned into the John F. Kennedy Memorial Highway, which was a toll road. So Khalil exited onto Route 40, which paralleled the interstate south and west toward Baltimore. Within half an hour, he crossed into the state of Maryland. Less than an hour later, he was on an interstate which took him in a circle around the city of Baltimore, then back to I-95, which had no toll at this point. He continued south. He had no idea why some roads and bridges were free while others had tolls. In Tripoli, they had no idea either. But his instructions had been clear. Avoid toll booths. Boris said, "They will at some point have a photograph of you at each place where you must pay." Khalil saw a large green and white sign that gave distances to various cities, and he saw the one he wanted. Washington, D.C., 35 miles. He smiled. He was close to his destination. It was nearly midnight, but there was still some traffic on this road that connected the two large cities. In fact, he thought, there was an amazing number of vehicles on the roads even after dark. It was no wonder why the Americans needed so much oil. He had once read that the Americans burned more oil in one day than Libya did in 1 year. Soon they would suck the earth dry of all petroleum. Then they could walk or ride camels. He laughed. At 12:30 a.m., he intersected the road called the Capital Beltway and entered it going south. He looked at his odometer and saw he'd traveled nearly 300 miles in 6 hours. He exited the beltway at an exit called Suitland Parkway near Andrews Air Force Base and drove along a road that passed through shopping malls and large stores. His satellite navigator actually gave him the names of some lodging places, but he had no intention of stopping at well-known places. As he cruised slowly, he took the plastic bottle of urine and threw it out the side window. He drove by a few motels, then saw one that looked sufficiently unpleasing. A lighted sign said vacancies. Khalil pulled into the parking lot, which was almost empty. He took off his tie, put on his glasses, and exited the Mercury, locking the door. He stretched for a second, then strode into the small motel office. A young man behind the counter was sitting and watching television. The young man stood and said, "Yes?" "I need a room for 2 days. $80 plus tax." Khalil put two $50 bills on the counter. The clerk was used to cash guests and said, "I need $100 for a security deposit. You get it back when you check out." Khalil put two more $50s on the counter. The young man gave him a registration card, and Khalil filled it out using the name Ramon Vasquez. He put down the correct make and model of the automobile, as he was told to do, because it might be checked later when he was in his room. Khalil also put down the correct license plate number and pushed the card to the clerk. The clerk gave him a key on a plastic tag, his change, and a receipt for his $100. He said, "Unit 15, to your right when you walk out, toward the end. Checkout is at 11. "Thank you." Khalil turned and left the small office. He went to his car and drove to the unit marked 15 on the door. He took his overnight bag, locked the car, and entered the room, turning on the light switch, which illuminated a lamp. Khalil locked the door and bolted it. The room was furnished very simply, he noted, but there was a television, which he turned on. He undressed and went into the bathroom, carrying his overnight bag, his bulletproof vest, and the two .40-caliber Glocks. He relieved himself, then opened his overnight bag and took out the toiletries. He pulled his mustache off, then brushed his teeth and shaved. He showered quickly, his pistols on the sink nearby. Khalil dried himself, took the overnight bag, pistols, and bulletproof vest, and re-entered the bedroom. He dressed again, putting on clean undershorts, undershirt, a different tie, and socks from the overnight bag. He also put on the bulletproof vest. He got out the tube of toothpaste with gum for his mustache, and he stood in front of the bedroom mirror and reaffixed the mustache. Khalil found the television remote control, sat on the bed, and changed channels until he found a news station. This was a taped replay of an earlier news broadcast, he understood, but it might be useful. He watched for 15 minutes, then the newsman said, "More on the tragedy at Kennedy Airport this afternoon." A scene of the airport came on the screen. He recognized a view of the security area off in the distance. He could see the tall tail and the dome of the 747 rising above the steel wall. The man's voice was saying, "The death toll is mounting as airport and airline officials confirm that toxic fumes, apparently from unauthorized cargo in the cargo hold, have killed at least 200 people aboard Transcontinental Flight 175. The newsman went on a while, but there was nothing to be learned from this report. The scene then went to the arrivals terminal where friends and relatives of the victims were weeping. There were many reporters with microphones, Khalil noted, all trying to get interviews with the weeping people. Khalil found this odd. If they thought it was an accident, what difference did it make what these weeping people said? What did they know? Nothing. If the Americans were admitting to a terrorist attack, then certainly these hysterical people should be filmed for propaganda purposes. But as far as he could tell, the reporters only wanted to know about friends and family on the flight. Many of those interviewed, Khalil realized, were still hoping that those they were waiting for had survived. Khalil could tell them with absolute certainty that they had not. Khalil kept watching, fascinated by the idiocy of these people, especially the reporters. He wanted to see if anyone spoke of the fireman on board whom he had murdered, but it was not mentioned. Neither did anyone say anything about the Conquistador Club, but Khalil knew there would be no mention of that. He waited for his picture to come on the screen, but it did not. Instead, the scene shifted again to the newsroom, where the newsman was saying, There is still speculation that this aircraft landed itself. We have with us a former American Airlines 747 pilot, Captain Fred Eames. Welcome. Captain Eames nodded, and the reporter asked him, Captain, is it possible that this aircraft landed itself with no human hand at the control? Captain Eames replied, Yes, it is possible. Matter of fact, it is thoroughly routine. The pilot added, Almost all aircraft can fly a pre-programmed route, but the newest generation of airliners can also automatically control the landing gear, flaps, and brakes, making a totally automatic landing a routine operation. It's done every day. The computers, however, do not control the reverse thrusters so that an aircraft landing on autopilot needs more runway than it normally would, but at JFK this isn't a problem. The man went on a while. Asad Khalil listened, though he wasn't that interested. What interested him was that no federal agents were on the television, and there was no mention of him and no photo. He guessed that the government had decided not to tell what they knew. Not yet.